my happy home to see what I could find out. I left my folk and friends with the aim to clear my mind out. Hit the rowdy road, many kinds I met there, many stories told me all of the way to get there. Ooh. So on and on I go, the seconds tick, the time out, there's so much left to know when I'm on the road.
Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling on KKRN 88.5 FM. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers and advocates from around the world. We are now streaming live on the Internet. Go to kkrn.org and click on the Listen button. KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners and underwriters like yourselves. Your support keeps us on the air, so don't hesitate. Go to kkrn.org once again and click on the donate button. Monthly donations help us plan ahead and keeps us on the air. Don't hesitate. Donate something to your local community radio station. If you have something you want to say to me off the air, you can email me at unspun@kkrn.org. Usually, Unspun is a call-in show, but because today's show is pre-recorded, we will not be taking calls in the studio as we usually do. Today, our guest is Allison Weir. Allison Weir is president of the Council for the National Interest, founded 20 years ago by former congressmen and ambassadors to work for Middle East policies based on American interests and principles. And she is also executive director of If Americans Knew, a think tank dedicated to providing Americans with information on topics of importance that is misreported or underreported in the American media. Allison is the author of Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel. In 2001, after a trip to Palestine and Israel, she founded the website ifamericansknew.org, dedicated to fact-based reporting. If Americans Knew has completed 7 in-depth statistical studies of U.S. media coverage of Palestine and Israel. This website is highly valuable to anybody that cares to go there. They have virtually every piece of information necessary to understand Israel, Palestinian, and the conflicts in those countries. I highly recommend that anyone interested visit the website. That's the website is ifamericansknew.org, and we'll have links on the KKRN website in the archives to that. Allison Weir was last on with us only a month ago, and at the end of that show, I realized there was a lot more we could learn from her, and she has graciously accepted my invitation to come back and share more with us. So let's welcome our guest, Allison Weir. Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling.
Hi, thank you so much for asking me to be on your show again.
It is a great honor, truly. I'm always amazed at the number of wonderful, good people that are out there telling the truth in the world today. And so to find your website and to find you and to have you on a show is an honor for me. And thank you for what you do.
Thanks.
When you were on last with us, we talked a lot about Israeli Zionist history and the media bias and the U.S.-Israel lobby's influence on our government. And I realized later, and I had mentioned it to you, that we hadn't touched on the effects of the neocons in American lives. So I'd like to just start with a brief history of the neocons. Maybe you can tell us who they are and what their involvement in our history in the United States is.
Sure. Neocons are, as you know, that's short for neoconservatives. A lot of conservatives think these people are conservatives, but actually, in many of the cases, they're former leftists, often really very far left, who then decided that the left and liberal section of the our citizens were starting to wake up to Israel-Palestine, and they switched and became conservatives, allegedly. They don't share much of the conservative belief in small government, et cetera, but they very much push Israel as supposedly a strategic ally for the United States. These neoconservatives are, one of their identifying characteristics is that they are very concerned about Israel. That's probably their greatest concern. Most of them, not all of them, but most of them are Jewish. This is written about openly in the Israeli media. And they have been getting, they really began to have a dominant role directly inside the U.S. government administration with George Bush Jr. when they attained high levels of influence and prominence and decision-making. And at that time, they still now are pervasive throughout the U.S. policy making. For example, Obama's supposedly mediation team and his team that would help the Israeli-Palestinian negotiators achieve some sort of peace process was dominated by neoconservatives. I believe every single one of them was someone who was an Israel partisan. And this was supposedly our neutral U.S. negotiating team, when in fact it didn't represent the general public. It didn't represent what was best for the U.S. or what would actually lead to some sort of solution and compromise in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. To get to some of the, a number of people who have written about this group for many years, when I first woke up to this issue, started to wake up to it, back in fall of 2000 and then early 2001, and began reading books about it, I read a book by an author named Kathleen Christensen, who had been a CIA analyst for many years and was now retired and was becoming, really has become quite a strong peace advocate. She wrote a book called Perceptions of Palestine. And in there, that was the first place I read about these neoconservatives. She talked about Douglas Feith, for example, who was Deputy Undersecretary of Defense in the Pentagon, and wrote about how not long before that he had written a position paper for Benjamin Netanyahu about what would be best for Israel. And in that position paper that was authored by other American neoconservatives, he had written that a Pearl Harbor-like event would be very helpful for Israel, that there were three countries, I believe, were specified as potentially might eventually become a danger to Israel. Those were Iraq, Iran, and Syria. So she was exposing this early on, and yet I discovered that nobody in the Palestinian movement that I talked to or was around seemed to even know about that or ever talk about that. When I began to mention that at some of my talks, people would say, oh, you know, that's an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. Yet, you know, fortunately, in the subsequent years, more and more of this information came out. Kathleen Christensen wrote a number of articles about it for Counterpunch. A number of other authors have written about it. Then a man named Dr. Stephen Snigosky wrote an entire excellent book called The Transparent Cabal, in which he documents the neoconservative push for the Iraq war, and really very much documents that is the reason that the U.S. invaded Iraq. There were other factors in it, but the dominant factor, according to this book, and I feel it's accurate, was these neoconservatives acting on behalf of Israel, not on behalf of the United States at all. Kathleen Christensen Counterpunch article said, let's be honest about this. We're talking about dual loyalties here. And I would say it's not even dual loyalties. I would say many of these people, I feel, have a stronger loyalty to Israel than they do to the country they are supposedly serving in government for, the United States. To give you more of the names, I just mentioned Douglas Feith as one of the prominent ones. There's also Paul Wolfowitz, who was another Deputy Secretary of Defense, Richard Pearl, who held a number of high positions. He was nominated for all sorts of powerful positions. There's Louis Scooter Libby, who was Vice President Cheney's Chief of Staff, who was in charge of the Office of Special Plans that fabricated or sort of created the so-called evidence for the weapons of mass destruction that supposedly were in Iraq that we now know were complete. This was all completely false, but Scooter Libby was very, very prominent in that work. There were assistant secretaries named Peter Rodman and Doug Zottheim, who actually were in the Reagan administration. These are strong neoconservatives. At lower levels, there were representatives at the Syria-Lebanon desk, at the in the Pentagon. Many of these are taken from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. It's important for people to know what the Washington Institute for Near East Policy is. This is an organization that was spun off from AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, that is a very publicly announced advocate for Israel. So whenever you see YNEP, Washington Institute for Near East Policy, it's important to know this is an entity that is part of the Israel lobby. People that work there are working on behalf of Israel. There are other individuals. There's David Wormser, who was very important. He co-authored the strategy paper for Israel Prime Minister Netanyahu that I just mentioned. In fact, they actually were two strategy papers that he co-authored. His wife, Naras Wormser, is another one of these neoconservatives. She's a co-founder of, you know, there are all these entities that they have in Washington, D.C., with, you know, all sorts of different names. There's one called Middle East Media Research Institute, MEMRI, that's M-E-M-R-I. This was founded by Naras Wormser with retired Israeli military and intelligence officers. They specialize in translating and circulating any negative Arab media report that they can find. So it's as though someone came to the U.S. and looked for every really grotesque incident in the United States of violence or extremism, and certainly, you know, sadly many of those exist. I don't feel they represent our population, but they exist. So they use this for the Arab world. They find some grotesque, really distasteful kind of statement or incident and write about it and then distribute it widely and push it as though this is representative of the region. And again, this is done by people who are doing it on behalf of Israel as part of their agenda to get all Americans to fear and hate Muslims. And at the same time, they very much want Muslims and Arabs to fear and hate the U.S. There's this divide and conquer thing that's been going on now for many decades.
Well, let me.
There's William Crystal, just to name another one, former Stalinist who became a quote conservative, but really a neoconservative. List goes on and on. If you go to the If Americans New website, we have a whole section on neoconservatives.
Yeah, let me remind our listeners: you're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With us today is Allison Weir, returned to be with us, actually. She is an author, researcher, and advocate for truth and justice in the Middle East, and we're discussing the neocons, who they are, and how they have affected American lives. Today's show is pre-recorded, and we will not be taking calls in the studio like we usually do. Now back to our discussion. Do you think the neocons came out of the Zionist movement, or did they kind of just attach themselves to the Zionist movement as a way to gain power and influence?
Well, I think they very much came out of the Zionist movement. I think they're ideological, emotional Zionists. They probably grew up that way. The indications are they grew up that way. So, no, I don't think they're just... I think some of the others that are within this realm are opportunists who see, okay, this is where the power is. They have, you know, massive amounts of money. We've been trying to add up the amount of annual budget for the Israel lobbyists in the billions of dollars. It's way beyond, you know, 6 billion is what we have so far, and I'm sure it's quite a bit higher than that. So this is a very powerful, well-funded group. So other people have joined it, I think, for opportunism. You know, not because they're really ideological Zionists, but they see this is a powerful group to be connected with. But I think the major members and the creators of it are very much ideological Zionists. And for listeners who might not know what that term is, I certainly had never heard of it before. It's not a widely understood term throughout the U.S. A Zionist is someone who believes in creating and then maintaining a Jewish state in Palestine. It's not a religious term. It's not an ethnic term. It's a term for an ideology where one is in favor in pushing a Jewish state in Palestine, even though Palestine originally was 95% non-Jewish. And even at the time of the creation of Israel, after decades of Jewish immigration and Zionist immigration to Palestine, was still at least 70% non-Jewish. And Israel was created through a very ruthless war of conquest.
I want to come back to some of these individual neocons that have stood out in my mind over the last at least 15, 20 years. And one of those would be Richard Perle. And I remember on the day that George Bush launched his illegal invasion of Iraq in 2003, Richard Perle was in London, and he was on the news or wrote an article, I'm not sure which, in from London, an op-ed, and he said, "Thank God the UN is dead." Can you tell me more about Richard Perle and what significance does that statement have for a Zionist or a neocon?
Well, the neocons have become very anti-UN because the United Nations, despite originally being the General Assembly was bribed and threatened into passing a partition recommendation in 1947 in which 55% of Palestine would be given to a Jewish state, even though, as I mentioned, the Jewish population was only 30% and Jewish ownership was probably only around 5 or 6%. So, you know, at that time, they used the UN, and now they like to claim that the United Nations created Israel, which is not the case at all. But then over, actually fairly early on, the United Nations passed resolutions that supported human rights for Palestinians, and including the right of return for Palestinians was a recommendation that was passed by the General Assembly afterwards. And in fact, when the United Nations allowed Israel to this newly created state of Israel, which was created through a war of ethnic cleansing, was allowed to join the United Nations under the agreement that it would abide by these resolutions, including the right of return for Palestinians. Israel has never done that, but that was the agreement, that was the promise they made at that time. But because the UN has been increasingly and through the years, passed many resolutions condemning Israeli violence. Israel has conducted many aggressive wars, many aggressive and very violent invasions, and these get condemned by the United Nations, both the General Assembly, and at times, when the U.S. doesn't veto them on behalf of Israel, in the Security Council itself, which gives them really supposedly a force of law. Because of that, the neoconservatives now don't like the UN. So you see a lot of anti-United Nations activism in the United States among conservatives. And what most conservatives don't know is this is being pushed by individuals such as Richard Perle, who has loyalties to Israel, to a foreign country, not to the U.S. So that's, you know, his statement is very much in that context. Richard Perle, I'm trying to remember, you may remember more about him specifically than I do. I do remember he was, I believe, appointed by George Bush to the
Defense Policy Board, I think you're talking about. Yeah, and Henry Kissinger sat on that board also, but very few people knew that. They quickly bowed out and just went underground almost immediately. Well, like I say, Richard Perle was giving his opinion about the UN from London, and that was the day that George Bush actually launched the illegal invasion of Iraq. And that's why it stuck out so much in my mind, because not only were he and Wolfowitz hand in hand with Netanyahu's government, but they were in the White House at the same time pushing for Israeli goals around the world. And one of the questions I had for you is, and it occurred to me, I mean, would we actually be involved in this horrendous war on terror if it weren't for these people?
No, I don't think we would. I don't think we would. Yeah. These people are responsible for massive carnage, massive tragedy in the Middle East and in the U.S. You know, look at all these soldiers that went over to serve and felt they were serving an honorable country in an honorable cause. You know, this was pitched as, well, you know, just various ways were pitched. Oh, this is their weapons of mass destruction there, which was, of course, completely false. We're bringing democracy to the Middle East, and what has resulted is chaos and anarchy, which was very predictable from the start. You know, it was being sold as something necessary and patriotic to do, when it turns out that was a completely false sales pitch. So we have these soldiers that many didn't come back. Many were killed over there. Many came back, you know, profoundly injured, physical injuries, psychological injuries, all sorts of trauma, all unnecessary. And now the same group is trying to push the same thing against Iran. Let's go in and create tragedy and misery to another huge population of men, women, and children. You know, let's create the kind of economic embargo that really constitutes an act of war against Iran, which has done absolutely nothing to the United States whatsoever. But this was done, as you'll recall, against Iraq. Even before there was the physical invasion, there was the blockade that caused the death of something like 5,000 children.
No, I think it's 500,000. I know that's...
but I'm talking about per month.
Oh.
Per month. It was 5,000 per month.
Yeah.
Small children. This does, you know... And this was Madeleine Albright, who's one of these neoconservatives, was confronted with that. How do you feel about that? And she said, well, we think it's worth it. You know, I don't think many of us would think it's worth it. And so this is what was going on before there was even the massive invasion that killed, you know, hundreds of thousands more people.
And this was already going on
against Iran.
Yeah, I wasn't aware that Madeleine Albright was a neocon. That's something I'm learning here today. I was aware of her comment because it was so crass and dehumanizing of the Iraqi people, and that's why it stuck out in my mind at the time even. And, of course, we don't know the full number of innocent people that were murdered during the Iraq invasion. I call it an invasion because it was never a war. We knew in a matter of weeks that we would be in control of Iraq when we went there. And I think Colin Powell, who was coerced into going along by these same neocons, has regretted that ever since, because he went to the UN and sold the weapons of mass destruction idea to them. Which brings me to another neocon, Scooter Libby. I mean, you kind of mentioned him, but he was very important in this run-up to the Iraq invasion. Would you tell us a little more about him, other than the fact that he's a felon? And I think we should point out that some of these people are criminals.
That's right. Some are already criminals. Some are yet to be found guilty, but certainly are, I feel, would be found guilty when and if there's ever a prosecution. Scooter Libby was working in the vice president under Cheney, and he was very much pushing the Iraq invasion. He was working with Douglas Feith, who was at the Pentagon. And I would encourage listeners to go to our website, If Americans Knew, or I'm also president of another group called Council for the National Interest.org. Both of these websites have videos of the summit that was held last March in the National Press Club. It was called the National Summit to Reassess the U.S.-Israel Special Relationship. And at that summit that took place all day, we have videos of each of the speakers, really very high-level former CIA, FBI analysts and officers, some high military officials, a number of scholars, a number of experts. And one of the speakers was a retired lieutenant colonel named Karen Kitkowski, who was in the Office of Special Plans or associated with it in the Pentagon during this period, and describes firsthand what she saw. She saw that Feith was very much pushing them to create reports that would make it look like it was necessary to invade Iraq, that there were, you know, quote, weapons of mass destruction, that type of thing. And he kept talking about Scooter. And she wondered who is the Scooter, and of course it was Scooter Libby that they were working together on that. So her talk is very interesting because it describes firsthand from the inside what was going on there. She also described that Israeli generals would come to the Pentagon and go to meet with Douglas Feith. Now, when an outsider, somebody who's not somebody employed in the Pentagon, comes to the Pentagon, they are supposed to be escorted to the office that they are going to visit, both for security arrangements and because, as Karen Kitkowski said, it's a very complex place. You can easily get lost in it. So she would go, she was one of the people who would escort these Israeli generals. And she discovered that they she'd be following them. They'd be striding there. They knew the way so well to go to Feith's office. Then when they got there, there was a procedure where you're supposed to sign in, again, part of the security of the Pentagon. You sign in who was there, when they arrived, who they visited, etc. She noticed they didn't even bother to sign in. So I would encourage people to look at that. And this is going on, this is just pervading our government. It went on then. The type of thing is still going on now. And something I've been wondering, especially with Wolfowitz, but now I'm wondering about more and more of these people. I wonder how many of them are actually Israeli citizens. Very little has come out on that. We know that Rahm Emanuel, Obama's chief of staff in the White House, a very influential, powerful position. We know that Rahm Emanuel had Israeli citizenship, that during the first Gulf War, when the U.S. was at war, Emanuel went over and volunteered with the Israeli forces. So we know that specifically, but I would suspect somebody like Wolfowitz, whose family went over to Israel when he was a teenager, was very close, lived there. His family lived there for a number of years. His sister is an Israeli citizen. It would be standard procedure for a family like that to become an Israeli citizen. It's almost automatic, it appears. I've been researching this. When you're Jewish and you land in Ben-Gurion, you're almost automatically conferred with Israeli citizenship. I'm trying to look into the details of this more. But I would suspect that quite a few people of these may, in effect, not just have dual loyalties, they may have dual citizenship. And I think that this should be disclosed to the American public. If somebody is working in our government and they have citizenship in another country, we should know that. We might choose to allow it, or we might not, but we certainly should know it. And I think there should be a demand that we learn about whether these people are actually citizens of Israel. I suspect that many of them may be. We need to ask that question, and we need to get an honest answer about it.
Let me interrupt one more time to tell our listeners you're listening to Unspun, an Experiment of Truth-Telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With us today is Allison Weir, author, research advocate for truth and justice in the Middle East. And we're discussing the neocons, the neoconservatives, who they are and how they are have affected and continue to affect our lives here today. So today's show is pre-recorded. We're not taking any calls in the studio, so thank you. And now back to Allison Weir. Yeah, this dual loyalties, I think, as Christensen describes it in her articles, is problematic, as you say, because, well, let me read the – there's a great Bible quote that really reflects on this. And the quote is – let's see, where do I have it here? I have it somewhere. No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. And I feel like this really applies in the situation of the neocons, their influence. And I think there are people, as you say, I read something, and I don't know where now, just in my many travels around the internet, but there's something like 13 members of Congress and Senate that have dual citizenship. And I don't know where I got that, but that's pretty amazing if you think about
it. That's been going around. Mm-hmm. And that's part of – I have been wondering about this, you know, for many years, especially – you know, I guess the whole time I had learned about the neocons, so I've been wondering about it for over 10 years, but I hadn't researched it very much. Then when I saw this email saying, as you say, I think they gave it, you know, 13 members or something, including Barbara Boxer, who's — I live in California, so she's my senator. Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein could possibly both have dual citizenship. In this email, or, you know, article that's going around, it claims that Barbara Boxer does have dual citizenship. So I decided to try to investigate that and to discover whether that's true or not. Because the trouble is, this thing that's going around provides no evidence. I don't, you know, I think it's good that it's stimulating questions, but I'm concerned because I don't think it has any evidence, and we need to, you know, be aware that we need to know these, whether these statements are factual or not. So anyway, I looked into Barbara Boxer and looked into her biography. There's, you know, no mention that she has dual citizenship. Her parents weren't Israeli. There's nothing, no obvious thing that proves that she has dual citizenship. So I called her office. You know, I'm a constituent. You should be able to ask, you know, your local office about it. So I called her D.C. office, and I said, well, we don't know. I said, well, nobody there knows? And they just sort of said, no, we don't know. So I called her the local office in California and asked, you know, she has about 5 or 6 offices in California. So I believe I called the San Francisco office, and they said, well, we don't know. And I said, well, could you please find out, you know, if there's somebody there who knows? This is sort of significant. And they said, no, we just don't know. So then I contacted the I decided to try a few other offices, so I contacted the Sacramento office. And there the person said, yes, she has Israeli citizenship. So I said, oh, wow, you know, that's very interesting. You know, and then I wanted to know, well, how did she get it? Did she immigrate and specifically take it? When and how did she get that? So the person who told me that went and talked to somebody else, and she came back and said, no, actually, I was wrong. and then again, I think she said, well, the other places had basically been saying, well, there's nothing in her bio that says that she has Israeli citizenship, so we don't think she does, but they didn't really know. So then she said the same thing, well, there's nothing in her bio, so no, she doesn't have it. And I said, well, do you know that? How do you know that? Has anybody asked her? And, you know, again, I kept getting this runaround that nobody had asked her. So I finally went back to the D.C. office, and there I talked to the press person. By this time, I thought, well, I think, you know, I may write an article about this. This is ridiculous. So I talked to the press person there. When I write my article, put in his name. I don't remember his name right now. He's somebody who might also have Israeli citizenship. So he you know, I finally talked to I think he either called me, you know, I kept calling him and finally reached him, or he called me back or something. And then he finally said, no, she does not have Israeli citizenship. And so, you know, I said, so you know that for sure? You've asked her? You know that's definitely the case? And he, you know, he didn't ever respond about how he knew that, whether he had talked to her, whether she had said that. He just said it as a blanket statement, which is really not satisfactory. I'd like to know, does she say that or not? So that's as far as I've gotten on it. Since that time, however, I've come across a number of articles where one person in particular talks about arriving at Ben-Gurion Airport, which is in Israel, and already having a number of their citizenship, that it was really just sort of automatically conferred on that person, that you have to, it appears, specifically turn it down if you're Jewish. This is, you know, what I'm starting to discover. Now, I don't have it completely confirmed yet. I want to talk to some of my Jewish, you know, friends and colleagues and find out, is this what happened when you went to the Ben-Gurion Airport, or did that just happen to that one person? Is the standard procedure? But I've often heard mentioned that, well, it's very easy, it's sort of automatic, it's very easy to become an Israeli citizen. So again, Barbara Boxer, I don't know yet at this point whether or not she has dual citizenship. And these other people on that list, I sort of doubt. I my guess is that they're all Jewish, and so therefore, they're considering that Israeli citizenship. Now, is that unfair? Is that anti-Semitic? It's not necessarily unfair or anti-Semitic, because Israel, when it created itself, when the Zionists created Israel, they specifically, in a lot of their laws, have conferred, in essence, citizenship on Jews around the world. They conferred on Jews around the world ownership of the land in Israel. Something like 93% of it is allegedly held for world Jewry. When you're in Israel, you don't buy your house. You lease it for 99 years from this entity that's holding it for world Jewry. Now, there are some Jewish individuals, especially in Britain, there was a movement saying, we are English, we are Jewish, we renounce any sort of claim to be citizens and to be owners of the land in Palestine. So in essence, they're saying, you know, they're renouncing this dual citizenship that Israel sort of conferred on them. So it's not necessarily unfair to say, well, if somebody has not renounced that claim, then they are a dual citizen. You know, according to Israel, they are a citizen or an owner of the land in Israel. So it's sort of complicated. You know, is Barbara Boxer, are these people on that list dual citizens or not? And again, that's something that we should be looking into, asking. We should ask them, well, you know, it looks like Israel says that you're an owner of that land. Are you or not? it's a fair question. And, you know, again, as constituents, we have the right to know this information about our elected representatives. So I think it's a good thing to bring up and to start looking into more openly and honestly.
Yeah, and most certainly we can question whether they are blindly following Israel's lead on issues of national importance. I mean, that would be incumbent upon them to answer that question. Though I doubt, like you say, almost everyone that even questions Zionism or Judaism is not Judaism, but being Jewish is not just a religious thing. It's also a cultural and national. There are so many questions, and there are different facets to being Jewish, especially in
That's
America.
Right.
To question those things seems only normal to me. But as you say, people get accused of anti-Semitism when they bring up those questions.
Yeah, to get into what Jewish means, it's interesting because there's a debate about that very question among people who are Jewish. You know, some people, especially a number of anti-Zionists such as Alfred Lilienthal and Elmer Berger, Rabbi Elmer Berger, and today Alan Brownfeld, who say Judaism is, you know, being Jewish is a set of religious beliefs. It's a spiritual identity in which one believes in God and believes in certain religious beliefs. At the same time, there is an opposing interpretation that it is an ethnicity. And many people, I certainly have Jewish acquaintances, friends, and others who will say, well, I'm an atheist, but I am Jewish, because they consider it an ethnic identity, a tribal identity. And that is the way Israel treats it. They don't ask somebody when they come in, you know, do you observe religious law? Do you, you know, believe in God? Do you attend a synagogue? Do you have, you know, spiritual beliefs? You know, are you Jewish? You know, do you believe in the Jewish religion? They don't, those aren't the questions they ask. They ask about who was your mother, who was your grandmother. You know, mm-hmm. It's this. They identify it as a tribe, as a nationality, as an ethnicity, not at all as a religion. So it's a complex question. Mm-hmm. But when we're talking about Jewish identity, when we're talking about Israel, Israel just treats it as an ethnic identity, not as a religious identity.
Let's go back to the neocons, because in preparing for this show, just so many questions came up, and I became aware after following some of the links on your websites, and it just brought up more and more questions in my mind. So here was a big question, and this is kind of a long preamble to the question, but let me put this out there for you and for the listeners. Neocons were inciting President Clinton to attack Iraq in 1997. And in a policy paper released in 2000, they suggested it might take a new Pearl Harbor to bring about the transformation of the U.S. military they wanted to make the U.S. a hegemon of the world. And then Bush and the neocons entered the White House, and within a year we had 9/11, what I'm going to call their new Pearl Harbor event. Now, Bush had warnings from several intelligence agencies, we know that, from within and outside the U.S. about the possible attacks on the World Trade Center. And terrorism czar Richard Clark was jumping up and down with his hair on fire. Yet Bush and the neocons made no attempt to prevent the attacks of 9/11. And Richard Clark was banished from the cabinet meetings. And Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu actually made the statement that 9/11 was good for Israel. So my question is it possible that 9/11 was a real-life Zionist conspiracy, a false flag operation to bring the U.S. into line and into a military strategy with the Israelis? Do you think that's a possibility, or am I way off base here?
You're not way off base at all. I feel that it's very difficult to know what happened with 9/11. We do know the investigation was inadequate, to put it mildly. There are a lot of questions about 9/11, a lot of questions about different aspects of what went on in the U.S. government, about, you know, finding a passport in the ruins of heat that had destroyed three buildings, well, two buildings, and another was brought down. Somehow a passport would survive that. To me, I thought it was, you know, really laughable kind of thing. So it's an extraordinary event on so many levels. Of course, the most obvious level is the tragedy of all those lives that were lost, and then all the lives that have been lost since, allegedly because of it. But it's extraordinary. You know, every one of the theories, I consider the governmental description of what went on really strange, very hard to believe. I consider alternative theories very hard to believe. You know, it's such a astounding event that occurred that whatever went on is so very strange that at this point I don't feel I know what went on. I don't automatically jump to conspiracy theories, which is of course considered an epithet, whereas the government narrative is a conspiracy theory about these, you know, 13 conspirators from Saudi Arabia, etc. So I don't, you know, usually I look for the simplest answer rather than the most labyrinthine kind of thing that, you know, has a lot of shady characters. But in this case, I don't feel that I know really what went on. I do feel that this country needs a new, better investigation. I think that's extremely important to try to learn more about what went on. Maybe it will confirm what the government's saying. Maybe it won't. But we certainly need that investigation. And could Israel be guilty of a false flag attack against the United States? Well, it has been. The Israeli government and agencies within the Israeli government did that in Egypt back in something called the Levant Affair, where there were attacks by the Mossad in Egypt against Americans, against places where Americans gathered, certain cinemas, libraries, that type of thing, that were made to seem that they were being done by, quote, Islamic extremists, what we're seeing today. Back then it was the Muslim Brotherhood were supposedly perpetrating those attacks. Well, it came out one of the people who perpetrated one of the attacks was actually working for the Israeli Mossad. So it came out and the whole thing unraveled. It was a scandal in Israel. That's why it's called the Levant Affair. Levant was the foreign minister. He got the blame for it. He said he did not deserve the blame. It was actually Ben-Gurion who was responsible for it. Ben-Gurion is in some ways known as the father of Israel, the first prime minister. So this was specifically a Mossad act against the United States to create hatred, fear, and to divide us from the Arab world, from the Muslim world, from Egypt specifically. And that's now proved. There's no doubt about who did that and what its purpose was. That was a false flag attack on Americans. Then there was another incident that may have been a false flag or may not have been. Many people are asking for an investigation of this other incident, which was the Israeli forces attacked and tried to sink a U.S. Navy ship. They killed 34 Americans, and they injured, it's at least 174, it looks like 175 Americans were injured in that attack. So two-thirds of the entire crew was killed or injured in this attack on a U.S. Navy ship that went on longer than Pearl Harbor. This wasn't some sort of fog of war kind of, oh, by mistake we shot somebody. It was strafed, it was shelled from the air, napalmed. Then they set out torpedo ships. They fired torpedoes at the ship. One of them ripped a 40-foot wide hole in the ship that just, you know, miraculously the ship didn't sink. They then dispatched helicopters with armed commandos who were about to board the ship when finally they were called back. This has never been investigated by the United States government. That's horrendous. It's outside of the normal procedure is an attack like this on a U.S. Navy ship that was not taken. We weren't at war. This was a U.S. ship that was there in international waters monitoring the Six-Day War. Entirely our right to do that. It was largely an unarmed ship, and it was ferociously attacked by these Israeli forces. There was a one-week inquiry into crew behavior. You know, how well was the crew? How did they respond to this emergency these situations, they found they responded quite well. The person who was captaining the ship got the Congressional Medal of Honor. It's the most decorated crew since World War II, and one of the most decorated Navy crews in the whole history of the U.S. Navy. And yet these men are pushed aside. Their calls for a full, honest investigation, the type of investigation that would normally take at least 6 months, have been ignored. Most recently, American Legion top officials won't even let these veterans, these highly decorated, heroic veterans, they've prohibited them from even having a booth at the American Legion convention. Even though there's a great deal of evidence that American Legion members are very supportive of their fellow veterans. So this is a massive cover-up. And, outside the idea of the false flag thing, nobody knows for sure why that attack in which they tried to sink a Navy ship occurred. There were some things that are likely. Israel wanted to enlarge the war, even though the U.S. was telling them to stop it, even though the whole world was calling for a ceasefire. Their first attacks on the ship completely disabled the ship and prevented it from sending out any transmissions about what was going on, which would have achieved the Israeli purpose of not letting the world know that they were about to expand the war. But they continued the attack even after that, and they clearly were trying to kill every man aboard. The machine gun stretcher bearers, when there were life rafts that were deployed, they shot those up, and I believe they even took one aboard their torpedo ship. So it was clear they were trying to kill every man aboard. Why would they do that? Well, if you do a thought experiment, we know that if they had succeeded, if the ship had gone down to the bottom of the sea, the American public would have believed that the attack had been perpetrated by Egypt, because we were under the illusion that Israel was a friend of the U.S., and of course, Israel would never attack such a ship. So we would have thought that this was done by Egypt, and quite likely, the U.S. military would have come into the war, the Six-Day War, and would have attacked Arab nations. So some people suggest, and this is very plausible, that this too, like the Levant affair, was a false flag incident by Israel trying to get the U.S. to attack its enemies.
And what year was that, that the USS Liberty?
This was in 1967. But there was a briefing about it on Capitol Hill in 2003, chaired by a four-star admiral named Admiral Thomas Moorer, and co-chaired by a rear admiral. Part of the commission was a Marine general, General Ray Davis, who was the highest-ranking Medal of Honor recipient in the United States. This was in 2003, where they stated that this had constituted an act of war by Israel against the United States, that it had been ordered covered up by the President of the United States, who had recalled rescue flights to these American servicemen during the attack. Very, very, very strong statement by an extremely high-ranking panel on Capitol Hill in 2003, completely covered up. Nothing in the Washington Post, nothing in the New York Times, nothing in USA Today, nothing on Fox News. Massively covered up. But it's in the Congressional Record in detail. And it was written about in the Stars and Stripes newspaper, the military newspaper abroad.
Well, we have only about 4 minutes left, and I'd like you to talk about anything you'd like to talk about, something you'd want our listeners to know that you think is valuable and maybe related to what we've been talking about.
Well, I guess maybe one point I'd like to make is how important it is that we do something about this. This kind of information, I'm so glad that you're covering this on your show, because much of this information is being withheld from the American public. More Americans need to know this. I don't think it should be approached as a partisan issue. It's not a political issue. It's a very important factual issue. that more people need to know, and then we need to do something about it. We've started a campaign called Stop the Blank Check to Israel. We give Israel over $8 million per day of our tax money. This is far more than those to any other country on earth. In fact, per capita, on average, it's 7,000 times more than goes to other people around the world. It's extremely damaging. It perpetuates the violence there. It causes extreme hostility to Americans. It, of course, bleeds money away from our economy, which is in dire need of money. We have people losing homes here. We have schools that are often have overcrowded classrooms, and yet we're sending massive amounts of money to Israel. It's never debated. Our Congress never debates this. Both parties go along with it in lockstep to what the Israel lobby tells them to do. We have congressional and senators and Congress people who do time after time exactly what the Israel lobby tells them to do. Many of them don't actually like having to be puppets, but they feel they have to because their constituents don't know what's going on. And if they tried to say something, then the lobby would funnel large campaign donations to their opponent, and a candidate of integrity would lose the election because Americans don't know what's going on and their voters don't know what's going on. This is a dire situation. We need to speak about it. We need to share this information with others. And then we need to talk to our elected representatives and say, we want these policies to be rational, to be moral, to be in the best interest of our families as well as people around the world. And we are going to now vote on the stand you take on Israel-Palestine, on the amount of money you send to Israel. We are going to vote on this. This will be the issue that now we will pay attention to. Instead of up until now, too many of it, there are many important issues. So this issue has gotten shunted aside decade after decade and has smoldered and gotten worse and worse and worse. And now is the time I feel that we all should really focus on this issue. It's time to bring attention to it and to decide to change it.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Allison. I want to thank you for being on Unspun and Experiment in Truth Telling with us today. Bring so much to the table, and we will mention your websites on our website, and that's ifamericansknew.org, and also the other one, Against Our Better Judgment, which is a link to your book. So thank you very much for being on with us today.
Thank you.
A great pleasure to have you on, Allison.
And thanks for your show.
You've been listening to Unspun, an Experiment in Truth-Telling. Our guest today has been Allison Weir, President of the Council for the National Interest, author, researcher, journalist, educator, and advocate for peace in the Middle East. Her websites are ifamericansknew.org and againstourbetterjudgment.com. Next week on Unspun, our guest will be Ray McGovern, 27-year CIA veteran and briefer of presidents. Ray, an expert on Russian affairs, will have just returned from a jaunt through London to Moscow by way of Berlin. So tune in next Saturday, September 13th at 9 a.m. for Ray McGovern on Unspun, an Experiment in Truth-Telling.